Hi, I'm Jeff Davis, and you're listening to Wordplay, WPVM's program by about four, etc., poets, writers, their craft and their ideas. Today we're going to do something a little bit unusual. I'm alone in the studio today. Sebastian and Laura both out and about. So I'm going to replay a program originally recorded in November 2006, last year, an interview that Sebastian and I did with Thomas Raincrow. I'm playing that today for a very special reason, that Thomas Raincrow is going to be performing at the Black Mountain College Museum and Arts Center this coming Friday, September the 7th. So this will be a little preview and give you an idea of what his concerns, what his focus is. So here we go.
Our guest today is Thomas Raincrow. Thomas is a card-carrying member of the Baby Beats and former editor of Beatitude Magazine and Press, all of which thrived in San Francisco during the 70s. He's a poet, translator, publisher, anthologist, recording artist, as lyricist for the poetry and music band The Boat Rockers, and author of 15 books of original and translated work. As an activist, he was a founding editor of Kutua Journal, a bioregional journal for the Southern Appalachians, was a founding board member of AMUSE, Artists and Musicians United for a Safe Environment, and was project director during the 80s for the Project to Protect Native American Sacred Sites in the Southern Appalachians. As a writer on culture and the environment, he has been a feature writer for such regional publications as the Wild Mountain Times, Mountain Express, Blue Ridge Outdoors, and the Smoky Mountain News. He currently lives in the Tuckasegee community of Jackson County and has written a memoir on self-sufficient living and environmental ethics, Zorro's Field, My Life in the Appalachian Woods, which is now out in paperback from the University of Georgia Press. Welcome, Thomas.
It's good to be here. But agitator?
Well, I had to say it. Aren't you?
On a good day, yeah. Okay.
I thought we could start by having you read a poem from Zorro's Field, which sounds strange because it's a great memoir. It's a great nonfiction book. But each chapter in this book, as you know, because you did it, ends with a poem. And I really love that about this book. And I wondered, the After Han Shan poem, maybe, if that feels good.
Sure. How much alike are the wise man and the drunk? The wise man sees the light in the cloud, the one who drinks the cloud in the light, each seeing the same thing. How I love the way Han Shan laughs when he speaks, and in laughing, the way he cries. His dreams are like mine, full of maidens in cloaks of crimson silk. Wondering today the direction in which my life will go, the I Ching says, where disorder develops, words are the first steps. No word this time of crossing the great water, but a message of keeping still. So tonight I have made myself a cup of tea and sit with my friends, all the words I know. Having taken the first step toward tomorrow, I make a bold stroke with my pen that in this dim light looks like one of those court maidens Han Shan and I know so well. I sit for a moment in the trance of another world, far away from here, but like this small shack in the woods, still home.
At dinner tonight, you talked about that being a bit of a Snyder poem, and you said that with a laugh. Could you talk a little bit about that poem as well as kind of how you started or how you figured out that these chapters might end with poems?
Well, the actual organization of the book itself came kind of helter-skelter toward the end. I was really writing the narrative for a period of 2 years, and then when I actually put the manuscript together to send off to Georgia Press, I just stuck a poem at the end of each chapter, which really was a reflection of the narrative subject matter I was dealing with. I was able to find, in almost every case, a poem that I had written during that time frame, which was some 25 years ago now, that corresponded with the actual subject matter of the chapter. So the Han Shan poem was a poem that I wrote a long time ago, and while I was living in the woods next to Zorro's Field. And it was really kind of a knockoff of a Han Shan poem. And I learned about Hanshan, of course, from Gary Snyder. I lived for a while up along the San Juan Ridge in the Sierra foothills after my years in San Francisco in the community that Snyder lived in, as well as the Kuksu poets, the Back to the Land poets and artists, the community that was there. And that was there that I discovered Hanshan and some of Snyder's favorite poets.
Hmm. Well, I'm thinking about that time when you were living there in that kind of bioregional group, or one of the early bioregional groups around Snyder, and living in and around San Francisco. And I'm thinking about that anthology on Baby Beats that you're in and a part of, and all kind of all over that anthology. Could you talk a little bit about that time, a little more about that time, specifically about being a baby beat and looking to people like Snyder, maybe Patchen, Ginsberg, Rex Roth, Ferlinghetti? These are all people that you've talked about as possible tutelary figures. Kind of, what did you get from them? How were they influences on you, if at all?
Well, big influences. I mean, before I even arrived in San Francisco, the Beats were it for me. Mm-hmm. I'd grown up on other poets early on, but as soon as I discovered, it was Ferlinghetti's Starting from San Francisco that really turned the lights on for me, and I realized that, yes, as an American poet, you can write in an American diction, and you can write about subject matter that is present and appropriate and even partially taboo in the literary sense. So it was almost destiny in a way that I should end up in San Francisco to be able to hang out with some of my heroes. Ferlinghetti, of course, was there. Jack Micheline, Jack Hirschman, Philip LaMantia, Diane DePrima, David Meltzer, Bob Kaufman. I mean, the list just goes on and on. And these were folks that were just hanging out. And I was living in North Beach most of the time I was there. So I was rubbing shoulders and elbows and everything else I could rub up against these guys, hoping a little bit of it would fall off.
Rub off, right?
On a daily basis. And this went on for several years. And we did a lot of things together. We resurrected Beatitude magazine and brought the Beats on back on board along with us younger guys. We started organizing readings.
Bob Kaufman to read for the first time in years, didn't you, when you were there?
Yeah, we actually, he was, you know, kind
was
of...
breaking his silence, right?
He'd been kind of speechless in a matter of speaking for about 13 years. I happened to be in Malvina's coffee house the day that he broke his silence, so to speak, which was an incredible experience. You could do a whole show on that alone. But we quickly organized, once we realized he was out of the closet, so to speak, we quickly organized a reading, and absolutely we had people standing in the street. It was a word of mouth kind of thing, but we had the place packed. It was the old Spaghetti Factory in North Beach, and the place was packed, and there were people in the street all the way down the block just to hear Kaufman read after, almost 15 years of silence.
Public silence.
But it was that kind of a scene for several years, and we were very active as activists, but as also as just poets. Mm-hmm. And it was an incredible scene by the end of the 70s, and I often compare it to Paris and St. Petersburg and Moscow during the early part of the 20th century.
Great,
incredible audiences and a plethora of creative work going on all over the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've talked before about taking poetry to larger audiences, and obviously the Beats and a lot of what was going on then was doing that. And I think a lot of the music going on in that time also. You've talked about some of your influences, Jim Morrison and The Doors being one of them. Can you talk a little bit about the music going on in that time? And maybe we can also segue into hearing a cut. I think you have a Jim Morrison song or poem for us to listen to. But what were you listening to then? And were you making connections between the music and the poetry? Was the spoken word and the performance, was it all the same? Or were you pulling a little bit from here and a little bit from there?
Well, the truth be known, I wasn't listening to any music hardly at all during the 70s when I was in California. I was plugged into the poetic muse, and it didn't really include a lot of music. I was more interested in the natural lyric of the language. Mm-hmm. But I had been heavily influenced during the 60s by 60s rock and roll. Mm-hmm. And of course, as you mentioned, Jim Morrison was one of the people that I looked to as being a groundbreaker and a visionary of sorts. And so after I left California and came back and started really working seriously with musicians with my own work, I kind of used Morrison's An American Prayer as a reference point for creating a style and a kind of music for my own work. And then it went on from there. I've had various influences since then. But it really started with 60s rock and roll, I'd say.
Not a bad place to start. Let's listen to the first cut off American Prayer.
Is everybody in? Is everybody in? Is everybody in? The ceremony is about to begin.
Well, that's the beginning of the first track on American Prayer.
Yeah, what happened? I think we just like blew out the system.
I think Morrison's done it again. but let me just fill in a little bit. During the 70s, really, there was a lot of lyrical stuff going on, a lot of musical poetry going on, people writing in the lyric tradition that had a big influence on me. Of course, Kenneth Patchen, and his work with jazz musicians, Kenneth Rexroth was still alive, and I had some contact with him, and he did a lot of performance work with jazz musicians as well down at the old Black Hawk and some various places in San Francisco. So there was, and then people like Jack Michelin and Jimmy Lyons, these street poets originally from New York, who were now at that time living in San Francisco, whose natural musicality of their poetry was like a band in itself. They really didn't need any help. Their work is so lyrical. So there was all this kind of stuff just walking around in the street, embodied in these various poets. Jack Hirschman also, very lyric poet. So, you know, the music was really in the language, as I said.
Well, Thomas, one of the things that I just love about this whole tradition of what you're talking about is, I'm thinking about Jim Morrison probably loving Jack Kerouac, say. I mean, I know he was influenced by the Beats big time. And so 60s rock and roll being influenced by that stuff going on in the 40s and 50s. And then here you are kind of influenced by all of that, and as well as all the things that the Beats themselves were influenced by. Some of the, you know, surrealist stuff and Verlaine and Rimbaud. It's just great. I love that that rock and roll somehow got into that stream.
Well, the rock and roll was all part of a consciousness during the 60s. You know, everything was part and parcel of a revolution of sorts in the human consciousness, if nothing else, and amongst the young people. And that's my generation, and that's really where it started for me. And as I say, one thing led to another. But the whole scene, a lot of it then, as it was in the 70s later, was all about improvisation, spontaneity, you know, Joseph Campbell's Following Your Bliss, and all of that, all those philosophic notions, you know, made their way into people's approach and relationship with poetry or with, you know, writing and language. And that's what the whole beat scene was about for me. It was about being spontaneous and being honest and being streetwise. Mm-hmm. And it all came from the street. And we were hanging out in the cafes and the bars. We weren't, you know, getting our diplomas from the university for an MFA degree in creative writing. We were hanging out and just living and sharing work, like I say, in the cafes and bars. And that's really where I got my real literary education.
We should say here that we're listening to Wordplay on 103.5 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. The Progressive Voice of the Mountains, WPVM. Indeed, and it's a broadcast service of the Mountain Area Information Network. So that's the first part of the interview that we did with Thomas Raincrow back in November of 2006. The show coming up at the Black Mountain College Museum and Art Center will get underway at 8 p.m. on September the 7th. That's this coming Friday. Admission is going to be $8, $5 for members and students with an ID. The Boat Rockers consist of Chris Rosser, who's a fabulous instrumentalist, Wayne Kirby, who used to be a member of Debbie Harry's band, Blondie, who's now settled into the music department at UNCA, Doug Shearer, a percussionist, Nan Watkins, a wonderful keyboardist, Sal Dangio, and Greg Olson, also over at UNCA. Should be quite a hoot, so I urge you all, go out there, troop over to the Black Mountain College Museum and Art Center. That's 56 Broadway, right downtown in Asheville. Now let's listen to the second half of our interview with Thomas.
I'm going to read this to you, Thomas, because it comes out of a lecture that you gave, and it's a little bit of a long preamble for a question that I want to ask that hopefully will get us into the next phase here. How do you go about reading your work to music? Because I know you've done it for a long time, and I know in particular you've worked with the Boat Rockers for live concerts and as well as working on at least one or more CDs. How do you go about reading your work to music?
Well, it depends, really. I work improvisationally with my band, whether it's seven people or four people or two people. It just depends on who's on hand and what we're trying to do. It has more to do about the writing, I think, than the reading in certain ways. My writing process is a lot. Well, it comes. You mentioned Kerouac, and it's a first thought, best thought process, and it's done with a lot of trust and spontaneously. I hear subtle rhythms, and I try to create a wordplay following those rhythms, and the rhythm determines the word choice. And it also determines the cascading aspects of the poem. And then when I bring it to the band, again, it's improvisational. The band hears the poem, and they just create it, something that dovetails with either the essence of the poem or the natural rhythms of the poem or the message of the poem. It could be jazz riffs. It could be very new age kind of stuff, electronic. It could be heavy blues and rock and roll. It just really depends on the poem itself. And I work with musicians to enhance and expand the natural rhythmic structure in the written or the spoken language. And I've worked with keyboardists and cellists, guitarists, percussionists, and my motivation is partly pragmatic and practical, taking poetry to a larger audience, which is where the Jim Morrison influence comes in, and especially his American Prayer album. But I'm also motivated in this collaboration to create an independent genre, a spoken word and music genre, mm-hmm. To help get the word out. People are used to listening to music, to CDs, to radio, music concerts. Poetry has kind of a bad rap in this culture and probably well deserved, but in order to get it into the mainstream, we have to be creative. And one of the ways that I've decided to be creative with my own work is to use it with music.
We're going to play a cut from the Boat Rockers. Could you say a quick word about what we're going to listen to and the band itself? I think you said track 7, so I'm not sure.
Yeah, this is a CD that's the most recent CD. We did a live concert over at UNCA a few years ago, and it was recorded live, and it was a good enough quality to consider playing around with it in the studio and mastering it and see what we could come up with. And in the end, it came out real clean and real nice, and it's really reflective of the energy and the instrumentation and the poetry. This is the last piece that we did in that particular concert that night. It's sort of a summation piece by the Persian mystic poet Hafez. He talks about his relationship with writing and kind of a love-hate relationship he has with words.
Tell me what that song is called again, and like some of the musicians in that band, to kind of break it down.
Well, I've been blessed to work with some really great musicians over the years, and I've got a killer band right now. I call it a super group, and it really is. It consists of Sal Dangeo, who plays on this piece. He plays tabla and model drum. He's also a great guitar virtuoso. Nan Watkins on keyboards. Safed Farid on Doombeck and frame drums. The one and only Chris Rosser, who is the heart and soul of this Middle Eastern kind of music that we were playing on this particular album. He plays a number of different Middle Eastern traditional instruments. Wayne Kirby on Veda Electric stand-up bass, with vocals and effects. And Greg Olson, who plays a plethora of instruments, a very eclectic bunch of things, everything from the tambora to the mandolin to the flute to the harmonica, and also River Gregarian playing hand drums and percussion. So it's a big band.
Yeah, and what a sound.
And it's great to be out front of that much music and that much talent. And
yeah.
Working with musicians and performance also, it gives the spoken words the possibility of different textures, and it's wonderful too with good equipment and good sensitive musicians to lay the words out on top of this improvisational musical structure, and it's very exciting, and the result is always a surprise. It never happens the same way twice.
So. Yeah, well, you can tell it's such a trance-like song, and I can hear you. The words are buoyed by the music. I know you read a lot without music, and sometimes you perform on flute yourself. Is there a difference for you? There must be a difference between just reading your own work with just your voice, just yourself, and then reading with a band like this. Can you describe how they're different, or maybe...
Well, it's a big difference. It's a huge difference. It, like I said, it gives you this push from behind, and it forces you to project. I'm not a natural performance or a theatrical kind of poet or person. I'm pretty shy and reserved, really. But with a 7-piece band and all that goes with it behind, it forces me to step up and really project. And I need that. I love that.
Mm-hmm.
I love it when it happens. I love that push. And it gives the poem a whole different dimension as well.
Yeah.
When you've got all that going on,
so much more space you can let fall between phrases or words, knowing that it's going to be carried. And that must be what you mean by it not being the same. You can mess around a little bit.
Right. I'm always listening to the band, and that the band really dictates what I do.
Yeah.
They're often wanting to follow my lead, but I don't let them do that because they're the ones that have all the firepower, really.
We have just another minute or two. Do you want to read some of a few verses or a few sections from this Sickly that you have in front of you there?
Well, this is...
Am I pronouncing that right?
That's a Silky.
Silky. It's a Gaelic term. Sorry.
Yeah, it's a Gaelic term for the mystical, here we go. We're having one of these senior moments.
Two syllables.
This is a very lyric poem that... is kind of built to be read aloud without any accompaniment by any musical instruments, because I tried to incorporate the musicality by just using the language alone. Seals. The Silky is a seal.
That's right.
The mythic seal of the Irish. Silky. Salt swaying solitude of hush, smashing sandward toward dunes, swathed in chicanery of crash and wisp, almost as whisper, screamed, sensual, from the voice of stars. The sea side skip of smooth stone, soothing opening eyes. Soles of feet, fingers and shuffle of shoe-handed stomp, or symmetries in the slow motion of trot, makes mad movement the braille of water, weaving wetness into the elegy of air. Hush, she is. Crash. Hush, she is. Wind now walking through the ears of earth. Hear the hiss of innocence washing away the night, the sighing of songs teaching shells to talk, to walk in these waves. Hush, she is. Crash. Hush, she is.
And that's Wordplay for this week.